Running away doesn't seem to do any good.
Can't tell if any of the dead stood their ground. If they did, it didn't help.
The thing that bothers me most is we haven't seen any demon corpses laying around.
Dunno. Either there aren't any, or they make a habit of burying or eating their own.
They don't strike me as a burying kind.
Me either.
When they regained the main corridor, it was decision time. They could either keep moving in the direction they were headed, or backtrack.
Figure we're more than halfway across the dam, and we still ain't seen a stairwell.
To hell with it. Let's just go ahead. Maybe we'll come across one before we hit the end.
Good a plan as anything, I guess.
They had covered no more than 100 feet of corridor.
Where's that coming from?
Ryan stopped short and made the others stop too.
Quiet. Listen. They're in the walls. It's coming from the walls.
Baba needed to protect us.
Your demons are talking to you.
Or to each other.
They don't sound like four-legged animals to me. Never heard a four-legged critter make a racket like that.
It sounds more like birds or bugs.
Only big.
Yeah, big.
Ryan pushed forward, holding the torch as high as he could, trying to make the light penetrate the tunnel more deeply.
Got another gash coming up on the right wall.
Ryan saw it. A dark oval, 2 feet above the level of the floor. Beneath the opening lay a pool of acid slime. Ryan moved to the opposite side of the hole, and with his assault rifle aimed at the hole, prepared to give it the widest possible berth.
Huh.
He took a step back. Air exploded from the wall like a cannon shot, shaking the floor underfoot. The force of the explosion blew a mist of yellow all the way across the corridor. Something tightly plugging the burrow had moved forward so suddenly and with enough force to blast the air from the hole, like a gigantic plunger. The power required was almost inconceivable.
They're coming! Run!
Ryan pushed Jubilee ahead of him.
Back to the intake! Run!
Wicklaw and the Gren-wounded man took off with a speed they hadn't seemed capable of before. JB, Ryan, and Jubilee ran on their heels, forcing them to go even faster. Despite the threat, the third man couldn't keep up and quickly fell behind. As Ryan heard his footfalls drop back, several very strange things happened in rapid succession. The torch the third man was carrying landed on the floor in front of him. Then something zoomed past so quickly it was hard to believe it was real, high and tight to the ceiling, bounding through the air. Ryan got the impression of stripes, brown on brown, and then it was gone. Ryan stopped and turned. He could see the man sitting on the floor with his back to the wall, no longer screaming. He wasn't far. Ryan went back for him. When he jerked the man to his feet, a mass of slippery gray coils dropped out from under his robe and flopped around his ankles.
Oh, fuck.
Ryan saw the blood on the front of the robe and the gaping half-moon slice from hip point to hip point. He let go of the warm but dead hand.
Back! We gotta go back to the intake. It's the only place we can defend.
The perpendicular hallway was just around the bend. As they piled into it, they heard the sounds behind them. Very fast, very close. Ryan and JB pushed Jubilee, Wicklaw, and the other man ahead of them, through the narrow passage, then through the fissure and into the water channel. They all backed up against the grate. Ryan and JB stood shoulder to shoulder, facing the split in the wall. Ryan held the Galil braced against his hip. JB had both pistols raised in his hands. Torches were unnecessary. Even though the bodies blocked some of the light coming through the grate, they could still clearly see the fissure 25 feet away.
At least we know where it's coming from.
Are you ready for this?
Ready as I'm ever gonna be.
You can't kill them. No one can.
What the hell's that?
Something scraped in the narrow corridor. Scraped the floor, the walls, even the ceiling. Something sharp, something heavy. Then it too stopped. The silence stretched on and on. Ryan could feel the tension building in his arms and neck until it became a burning pain. He tried not to blink as sweat ran down either side of his spine. It came in a single bound, crossing 20 feet in an instant. It was big, all right, as big as a man, and no part of it was human. The ambushers had been lying flat on their bellies on the roof of the redoubt, waiting for the moment when all their targets stepped down into the stairwell death trap. With concrete walls on three sides and the steps on the fourth, there would be no escape. But all the targets didn't descend. The white-haired one remained at the head of the stairs, standing watch. The seven field hands had to lay there and listen as the would-be looters and defilers moved the last rock from in front of the door. It was plain from the stranger's talk that they knew how to open the tomb, and it was likely that one or more of them would enter the sacred place before the albino left his post. Although keeping them out of Bob and Enid's tomb was their prime directive, something they had to prevent at all costs, in the end it was an individual decision, not a group one, to open fire. One of the men had a machine pistol and took it upon himself to spray the enemy into submission. He jumped up with the H and K and fired full auto from the hip, sweeping a line of slugs across the top of the stairs, through the space where the white-haired stranger stood. Like a cat, the albino dove and rolled away. The bullets spanged off the concrete and the sides of the boulders. The rest of the ambushers popped up and started shooting. None of the other men had automatic weapons, but the effect of six people firing semi-automatic pistols, revolvers, and pump shotguns simultaneously was much the same. The companions were caught by surprise, but not flat-footed. They had been in similar situations many times before, and each of them knew what to do. Instead of frantically returning the wild volley of fire, just closing their eyes and hoping to hit something, they aimed their shots with deliberation, if not calm. The exchange of blaster fire was so intense, and the range so close, it was difficult to tell who was shooting whom. As he backed up the steps, Doc touched off a Lamaze shotgun barrel. The pistol's short barrel made for a wide spread of maul shot. It stitched both men from shoulder to shoulder, staggering them back on their heels. Through the dense cloud of black powder gun smoke, Tanner followed up with a round from the Lamaze pistol. The head of the man on the right snapped back as he took a slug to the temple, and the other shooter grabbed at his belly and dropped to his knees, doubled over at the waist. Flying slugs plucked at Christie's sleeve and grazed her hair as she put two tightly spaced .38 caliber rounds into the man with the machine pistol. Jack's .357 barked in time with a second shot and hit the same target. The force of the double impact blew the man off his feet and sent him crashing to his back. Gritting her teeth against the howling rain of lead and the ricochets sparking and whining all around her, Mildred backed up to the top of the steps, firing two-handed. Headshots were all she took. The ZKR had a butter-smooth double action. The trigger was set for combat, and the targets were stationary. Shooting gallery ducks. The last ambusher was jacking another round into the chamber of his pump gun when he was struck by half a dozen bullets. Jack, Christie, and Doc had him zeroed in and nailed. As slugs plucked at the front of his robe, his head exploded, flying into fragments. Their ears ringing, the companions checked the roof and made sure all the attackers were dead. Smoke from the battle was still drifting over the park as they climbed back down into the stairwell. While Doc and Mildred cleared the corpse from in front of the door, Christie tapped the entrance code into the keypad. The door popped open with a whoosh of trapped air. The door was 2 feet thick. It swung on huge bearing-mounted hinges, and its inside perimeter was gasketed with heavily greased seals. Beyond the entry door was a vanadium steel chamber, 15 feet long and 8 feet high. There were steel benches built into the opposite walls, but no windows. The floor had a large grated opening that looked like a drain. At the other end of the chamber was another door and keypad.
It's an airlock. When the reservoir covered this place, they used it for access. They pumped the water in or out, depending on whether someone was leaving or arriving.
Christie tried to open the second door.
Shit. Close the outer door, Christie.
Right.
When Christie did that and retried the code, the inner door opened. It, too, was massively thick and gasketed. The banks of lights inside the redoubt began to flicker and come on automatically.
Now that's a good sign. At least the nuke power is still up and running.
On the other side of the door was a security station with double bulletproof glass, machine gun firing ports, and a holding cell where incoming and outgoing personnel were confined while they were processed. The only way into the redoubt was through the holding cell. Its barred entry door was ajar, as was the one at the other end.
One would think that 500 feet of water would be sufficient to secure this facility.
Then one would think wrong. These folks were worried about uninvited guests and unauthorized exits. Look at the firing ports in the glass. Half of them aim into the building.
The air had a musty, slightly scorched smell. No one had been inside Minotaur in a very long time. As they passed through the holding cell, they could see through the bars and into the adjoining security office. Loose papers were scattered all over the floor. On a gray desktop, in front of a swivel chair, stood a blackened computer monitor and drive tower. Left on screensaver for a century, it had given up the ghost. On the far side of the security checkpoint, a wide concrete staircase led to the redoubt's first below-ground floor. A low-ceilinged central honeycomb of work cubicles and computer stations, ringed by managers' offices, storerooms, and mainframes. It was clear the place had been abandoned in haste. Spreadsheets were strewn everywhere. Chairs lay where they had been overturned. Other computer terminals had burned out as well. The flare of their imploding CRTs had left black scorches on the cubicle divider walls. Personal items, family photos, and oddball trinkets were still tacked up to the workstation bulletin boards.
The Ville folk had to have heard the shooting. They'll be coming down to investigate. When they find they're dead, they'll know what happened. That we're inside Bob and Enid's tomb. At that point, they'll control the only entrance with a force of more than 100. How are we going to fight our way out to free Ryan and JB?
Rat.
It's also possible that our hosts outside are privy to the unlocking sequence, part of Bob and Enid's legacy. And if that is true, they may be familiar with the lay of the land inside this redoubt. If they enter to do battle with us, we would face the same kind of overwhelmingly bad odds as in the park last night. We could easily be trapped in here.
If we aren't already.
We're committed now. There's no turning back. We have to find the Mad Trans unit, then locate the armory. Then we figure a way out for all of us. We don't have a lot of time. First of all, we need a map of this place.
In every redoubt, the location of a complete site map was invariably the same. They found the commander's office on the left side of the broad room. His name and title were emblazoned on the metal door in gold letters 3 inches high. Everything was as he had left it. Neat piles of documents lay in his outbox. The leather-trimmed desk blotter was cleared and shipshape. Pens in the ornamental desk set. Paperclips out of sight. Mildred rounded the desk to examine the framed photographs lined up along the wall. One of them caught her eye at once.
Come and have a look at this.
Mildred pointed at a picture of a man in a dark green military uniform, shaking hands with another man in a very expensive suit in front of an American flag.
That's our commander.
The soldier had iron-gray hair trimmed in a tight crew cut and a jutting lantern jaw. A fruit salad of medals decorated his breast. The taller man he was greeting, or being greeted by, wore an easy grin and had a practiced twinkle in his eyes.
And that was the last president of the United States.
Looks like a bit of a rogue.
Part of his charm.
Two photos to the right of the presidential shot, the same uniformed officer was smiling alongside a man and woman in buttoned-up lab coats with pocket protectors. The scrawny-framed woman had a Betty Crocker hairdo dyed black, a smear of bright red lipstick, and rouge spots on both cheeks. A face with all the animation of a doorknob. The lab-coated man was shorter than the woman, and virtually bald. His eyes and mouth turned up at the corners, giving him a vulpine look. This photo was signed.
To Colonel Robert Townsend, onward and upward, Dr. Enid Mead and Dr. Bob Schumer. Sweet mother of God. Not that Bob and Enid.
What are you talking about, Mildred? Do you actually know who they are?
I'm afraid so. I didn't make the connection with their first names. Everybody used to call them Mead and Schumer. In the years before Skydark, they were notorious poster children for the ethically challenged research scientists, academic outlaws. Their line of scientific research was internationally banned, but obviously unofficially condoned here in the States, and underwritten to the tune of this redoubt.
What was their field of specialization, Dr. Wyeth?
Gene splicing. Manufacturing brand new organisms from the construction plans of existing ones.
In other words, playing God.
Why was their work banned, Mildred?
There were religious conflicts, of course. All the major and minor religions went ballistic over the moral issue. But the global ban came about because of safety concerns from the scientific community. Bringing new organisms into the world is a very dangerous proposition. Theoretically, it's possible to create something that could threaten all of humankind and that we would have no defense against. Think of the world as a house of cards. Each card an organism that depends on all the others for support. Something designer made could upset the balance and bring it all crashing down. It could be a more efficient component, a stronger plant, a more successful breeder, or a new disease vector. Tinkering with species barriers offers the chance that the diseases of one will transfer to another, jumping the normal boundaries, which could set new and terrible plagues upon humanity.
What did they create?
Mead and Schumer started their work on a microscopic level, tailoring bacteria for specific tasks like the industrial production of pharmaceutical drugs.